This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Wife, a novel by Allifair Burke, performed by Exie Sands. In an instant, I became the woman they'd assumed I'd been all along, the wife who lied to protect her husband. I almost didn't hear the knock on the front door. I had removed the brass knocker 12 days earlier, as if that would stop another reporter from showing up unannounced. Once I realized the source of the sound, I sat up straight in bed, hitting mute on the TV remote. Fighting the instinct to freeze, I forced myself to take a look. I parted the drawn bedroom curtains, squinting against the afternoon sun. I saw the top of a head of short black hair on my stoop. The Impala in front of the fire hydrant across the street practically screamed unmarked police car. It was that same detective, back again. I still had her business card tucked away in my purse, where Jason wouldn't see it. She kept knocking, and I kept watching her knock, until she sat on the front steps and started reading my paper. I threw on a sweatshirt over my tank top and pajama pants and made my way to the front door. "Did I wake you?" Her voice was filled with judgment. "It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon." I wanted to say I didn't know anyone an explanation for lying around my own house, but instead I muttered that I had a migraine. Lie number one. Small, but a lie, nonetheless. "You should take vinegar and honey. Works every time." "I think I'd rather have a headache. If you need to talk to Jason, you can call our lawyer." "I told you before, Olivia Randall's not your lawyer. She's Jason's." I started to close the door, but she pushed it back open. "And you may think your husband's case is on hold, but I can still investigate, especially when it's about an entirely new charge." I should have slammed the door, but she was baiting me with the threat of incoming shrapnel. I'd rather take it in the face than wait for it to strike me in the back. "What is it now?" "I need to know where your husband was last night." Of all nights, why did she have to ask about that one? For any other date of our 6-year marriage, I could have offered a truthful account. I already knew from Jason's lawyer that this wasn't the stuff covered by spousal privilege. They could haul me into a grand jury. They could use my failure to answer as proof that I was hiding something. And a detective was at my door with what seemed like a simple question. Where had my husband been the previous night? He was here with me. It had been 12 years since a police officer last asked me a direct question, but my first instinct was still to lie. "All night?" "Yes, our friend brought over enough food to last the whole day. It's not exactly fun to be seen in public these days." "What friend?" "Colin Harris. He brought takeout from Gotham. You can call the restaurant if you need to." "Can anyone else vouch as your husband was here with you?" "My son, Spencer. He called from camp around 7:30 and spoke to both of us." Words kept escaping my mouth, each phrase seemingly necessitated by the previous one. "Pull up our phone records if you don't believe me. Now, please, what's this all about?" "Carrie Lynch is missing." The words sounded funny together. Carrie Lynch is missing. This woman who had been batting us around was suddenly gone, like a sock that never makes it out of the dryer. Of course it was about that woman. Our entire life had been about her for the last 2 weeks. My lips kept moving. I told the detective that we streamed La La Land before falling asleep, even though I had watched it alone. So many details tumbling out. I decided to go on the offense, making it clear I was outraged the police had come straight to our door when Carrie could be anywhere. I even suggested indignantly that the detective come inside and take a look around. But in reality, my thoughts were racing. I assured myself that Jason could answer questions about the film if asked. He had seen it on the plane, the last time he flew home from London. But what if they asked Spencer about the phone call? The detective was obviously unmoved by my exasperation. "How well do you really know your husband, Angela?" "I know he's innocent." "You're more than a bystander. You're enabling him, which means I can't help you. Don't let Jason take you and your boy down with him." I waited until the Impala had left to reach for my phone. Jason was in a client meeting, but took my call. I had told him the night before that I didn't want to speak to him again until I had made some decisions. "I'm so glad you called." With one stupid conversation, I had conformed to the stereotype. I was complicit now. I was all in. Jason, Carrie Lynch is missing. Please tell me you didn't do this because of me. Part 1. Rachel. 1. The first piece of trouble was a girl named Rachel. Sorry, not a girl, a woman named Rachel. Even teenagers are called young women now, as if there's something horribly trivial about being a girl. I still have to correct myself. At whatever moment I transformed from a girl to a woman, when I might have cared about the difference, I had other things to worry about. Jason told me about the Rachel incident the same day it happened. We were at Lupa, seated at our favorite table, a found pocket of quiet in the back corner of the crowded restaurant. I only had 2 things to report from my day. The handyman fixed the hinge on the cabinet in the guest bathroom, but said the wood was warping and would eventually need to be replaced. And the head of the auction committee at Spencer School called to see if Jason would donate a dinner. "Didn't we just do that?" he asked, taking a large bite of the burrata we were sharing. "You were gonna cook for someone." Spencer's in 7th grade at Friends Seminary. Every year, the school asks us to donate not only money on top of the extraordinary tuition we pay, but also an item to be sold at the annual auction. 6 weeks earlier, I opted for our usual contribution at this year's event. I'd cater a dinner for 8 in the highest bidder's home. Only a few people in the city connected me now to the summer parties I once planned in the Hamptons, so Jason helped boost my ego by driving the price up. I convinced him to stop once my item had gone for $1,000. "There's a new chair of the committee for next year," I explained. "She wants to get a head start. The woman has too much time on her hands."
"Dealing with someone who fastidiously plans every last detail months in advance, I can't imagine how awful that must be for you."
He looked at me with a satisfied smile. I was the planner in the family, the one with daily routines and a long list of what Jason and Spencer called mom rules, all designed to keep our lives routine and utterly predictable. Good and boring, as I like to say. "Trust me, she makes me look chill." He feigned a shudder and took a sip of wine.
"Want to know what that crowd really needs for an auction? A week in the desert without water. A cot in a local homeless shelter. Or how about a decent lay? We'd raise millions."
I told him the committee had other plans. "Apparently you're a big enough deal now that people will open up their wallets for a chance to breathe the same air." They suggested dinner with 3 guests at a, quote, socially responsible restaurant of your choosing. His mouth was full, but I could read the thoughts behind his eye roll. When I first met Jason, no one had heard of him other than his students, co-workers, and a couple of dozen academics who shared his intellectual passions. I never would have predicted that my cute little egghead would become a political and cultural icon. "Hey, look on the bright side. You're officially a celebrity. Meanwhile, I can't give myself away without getting rejected."
"They didn't reject you."
"No, but they did make it clear that you were the member of the Powell family they want to see listed in next year's brochure." We finally settled on a lunch, not dinner, and 2 guests, not 3, at a restaurant, period, no mention of its social consciousness. And I agreed to persuade one of the other moms to buy the item when the time came, using our money if necessary. Jason was willing to pay a lot to avoid a meal with strangers. Once our terms were negotiated, he reminded me that he would be leaving the following afternoon to meet with a green energy company based in Philadelphia. He'd be gone for 2 nights. Of course, I didn't need the reminder. I had entered the dates in my calendar, a.k.a. the family Bible, when he first mentioned it.
"Would you like to come with me?"
Did he actually want me to join him, or had my expression given me away?
"We could get a sitter for Spencer, or he could tag along."
The thought of ever returning to the state of Pennsylvania made my stomach turn. "The chess tournament tomorrow, remember?" I could tell that he did not, in fact, remember. Spencer had little in the way of organized hobbies. He wasn't a natural athlete and seemed to share Jason's aversion to group activities. But so far, he was sticking with the chess club. The subject of his intern, Rachel, did not arise until the waiter brought our pasta, an order of cacio e pepe split between 2 bowls. Jason let it slip like it was nothing.
"Well, something a little odd happened to me at work today."
"In class?" Jason still taught at NYU during the spring semester, but also had his own corporate consulting company and was a frequent talking head on cable television. In addition, he hosted a popular podcast. My husband had a lot of jobs.
No, at the office. I told you about the interns.
With the university increasingly upset, jealous, Jason thought, About his outside activities, Jason had agreed to start an internship program where he and his consulting firm would oversee a handful of students each semester.
One of them apparently thinks I'm a sexist pig.
He was grinning as if it were funny, but we were different that way. Jason found conflict amusing, or at least curious. I avoided it at all costs. I immediately rested my fork against the edge of my bowl.
"Please," he said, waving a flippant hand. "It's ridiculous. Proof that interns create more work than they're worth."
He smiled the entire time he described the incident. Rachel was in either the first or second year of her master's study. He wasn't sure. She was one of the weaker students. He suspected, but wasn't certain, that Zach, the associate he'd tapped with the job of selecting candidates, had included her for purposes of gender diversity. She entered Jason's office to deliver a memo she had written about a chain of grocery stores. She blurted out that her boyfriend had proposed over the weekend and held up her left hand to show off a giant diamond.
"What am I?" Jason asked, her sorority sister.
"Please tell me you didn't say that." Another eye roll, this time slightly less exaggerated.
"Of course not. I honestly don't remember what I said."
"And yet?"
"She says I was sexist."
"She said this to whom?" I was pretty sure the correct usage was whom. "Why would she say that?"
"She went to Zach. These are the kinds of students we're accepting these days. A graduate student who doesn't understand the hierarchy at the firm where she works. She assumes Zach has some kind of power because he was the one who hired her."
"But why was she complaining?" I noticed a woman at the next table looking in our direction and lowered my voice. "What is she saying happened?"
"I don't know. She started running on about getting engaged. She told Zach I said she was too young to get married, that she needed to live a little first."
"Was there something wrong with that?" I'd never had a job in a formal office setting. It sounded rude, but not offensive. I told Jason that there had to be more to it if she was complaining. Another dismissive wave.
"That's how ridiculous these millennials are. It's considered sexual harassment even to ask someone about their personal life. But if she barges in my office and starts telling me about her engagement, I can't say anything without melting the special snowflake."
"So is that what you said? That she was too young and should live a little, or did you call her a special snowflake?" I knew Jason's harshest opinions about his students.
"Of course not. I don't know. Honestly, I was annoyed by the whole conversation. I think I said something as a joke, like, 'Are you sure you're ready to get locked down?' Probably that."
It was a phrase I'd heard him use before, about not only marriage, but anything that was so good that you wanted to hold on to it forever. Lock that down. We put in an early offer on our house. It's priced to sell. We need to lock that down. A waiter telling us that there were only two more orders of Bronzino in the kitchen.
We're good for one. Lock that down.
I could picture him in his office, interrupted by an intern he'd prefer not to supervise. She's babbling about her engagement. He couldn't care less.
"You're still in school. You sure you're ready to lock that down?"
Jason had a habit of making teasing comments. I asked him again if that was all that happened, if he was sure there wasn't something else that could have been misconstrued.
"You don't know how sensitive these college students are."
The words burned, even though he didn't mean them to. I had never attended college.
"If Spencer turns out like these microaggression asshole whiners, I'll ground him until he's 40.
Seeing the expression on my face, he reached for my hand. "Spencer actually is special, not a special snowflake. He's not like these kids who were raised to think they're extraordinary, even though they're not extraordinary." Jason said he was kidding, and I knew he was, and I felt guilty because I realized I, like Rachel the girl intern, was being too sensitive, was feeling too special. "So now what happens?" I asked. Jason shrugged, as if I'd asked what he'd like to donate to the auction.
"Zach will deal with it. Thank God the semester's almost over. But screw her if she thinks she's getting a recommendation."
As I poured a little more wine into my glass, I really thought that was the only thing at stake in Jason's interaction with Rachel. Whether a graduate student would get a recommendation. It would be 4 days until I realized how naive I had been. 2. New York City Police Department, Omniform System, Complaints. May 14th. Occurrence location, 1057 Avenue of the Americas. Name of premises, FSS Consulting. Narrative. Victim states that suspect encouraged sexual contact during business appointment. Victim, Rachel Sutton. Age, 24. Gender, female. race white. Victim walked into precinct at 1732 and asked to file a complaint. She proceeded to report that a co-worker, Jason Powell, encouraged sexual contact between them. Victim presented calmly and did not appear distraught. When I asked her what type of sexual contact, she said he suggested that I should be sexual with him. When I asked her to explain what she meant by encouraged and suggested, she did not respond. I asked if there had been any physical contact between them or if he had threatened her or forced her to do anything she did not want to do. She abruptly accused me of not believing her and left the station over my repeated requests that she continue her complaint. Conclusion. Forward report to SVU for consideration of further action. Signed, L. Kendall. 3. The woman who called about Jason donating a meal to next year's auction was Jen Connington. I no longer use names when I tell Jason what is happening in the parts of our lives he doesn't see because I know he won't remember them. Jen is mother to Madison and Austin, wife to Theo, a top three competitor for Queen Bee of the Friends Seminary Moms, and newly appointed chair of the auction committee. When I picked up the phone, she said, "Hey there, Angie." My name isn't Angie. To the extent I ever had a nickname, it was Jelly, and only my parents ever used it. I guess women who shorten Jennifer to Jen assume that Angela's are Angie's. "Thanks so much for your offer to cater another dinner!" Exclamation points added. "But we thought you might want a break next year." We. I immediately wondered which of the other moms was involved in whatever change was about to be decreed. "Seriously, Jen, it's the least we can do." My use of we felt smaller. I immediately imagined her telling Theo over cocktails that night, how many times does she have to remind us that she used to cater to the rich and famous in the Hamptons? It was the only real job I had ever had. At the time, I was pretty proud of myself. But women like Jen Connington would never stop seeing me as someone who had peaked as the help. "Well, call me a radical feminist, but we thought it was about time for some of the dads to do their equal share, so to speak." She laughed at her play on the title of Jason's best-selling book, Equalonomics. "Don't you think we should convince Jason to come out of hiding?" I had told her I wish he were in hiding. I would see him more often. Jason's trademark thing was how companies could maximize profits by making corporate decisions based on principles of equality. It was perfect fodder for liberal Manhattanites. Keep your 1% of perks and be a good moral person all at the same time. His book spent nearly a year on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list before it was released in paperback to enjoy another 40-week run. In the time that passed, the media appearances to promote the book evolved into stints as a talking head, which led to the podcast. And at the suggestion of his best friend, Colin, he started an independent consulting company. I was happy for him, happy for us. But neither of us had adjusted to his newfound celebrity. My catering prize would no longer suffice for our auction give. Jen tried to soften the rejection by returning to her theme of letting Jason do his fair share of the work. "Every year the moms bust their butts for this auction. Next year, we'll let Dad do the work." It was the second time she had referred to Jason as Spencer's dad. I didn't correct her. There was no reason to. When Jason and I, to my surprise, started to become serious the summer we met, I could tell how hard he tried to include Spencer. He taught him how to duck dive waves at Atlantic Beach, played tennis with him at the courts in Amagansett, and climbed to the top of the lighthouse at the end of Montauk, a summer adventure intended for one-time tourists, but which Spencer never tired of. When autumn arrived, Jason asked us to move with him to the city. God, how I wanted to say yes. I was only 24 years old and had only lived in two places, my parents' house and a house in Pennsylvania I would have never gone back to, even if the city hadn't torn it down. I had never really had a relationship with a man who had met me as an adult. I dated a couple of guys on and off who I knew from childhood, but nothing that would have ever led to marriage. The last thing I wanted was to be another generation of EastEnders barely scraping by in life, especially when I wasn't in love. And Jason wasn't just a good man who loved me. He was educated, intellectual, and refined. He had a good job, an apartment in Manhattan, and apparently enough money left over for a Hamptons rental in the summer. He wanted to take care of me. I could finally move out of my mother's house. I could work year-round in the city instead of having to work my ass off every day all summer trying to squirrel away enough cash for us to make it through the off-season. But I couldn't. I wasn't the main character in a fairy tale, ready to be saved by Prince Charming. I was a mother to a 6-year-old who didn't speak until he was 3, whom the doctors said might be autistic, merely because of his silence and a tendency to avoid eye contact, who required supplementary tutoring during kindergarten to prepare him for what I wasn't supposed to call the normal classroom, rather than the special one his kindergarten teacher was suggesting. He was now about to start first grade at a school where he had friends, and the only stable home he had ever known. I couldn't uproot him into the city for a man I'd known for 3 months. When I told Jason I couldn't move, I was prepared to say goodbye, both to him and to our whirlwind romance. I tried to tell myself that other girls my age would have had a summer fling by now. Again, Jason surprised me. He rode the train out from the city every other weekend, staying in the cheapest room at Gurney's with a view of the parking lot. He helped Spencer with his homework. He even managed to endear himself to my mother, who doesn't like anyone. In December, I accepted his invitation to bring Spencer into the city to see the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. We went ice skating. It felt like a movie. For the first time since Spencer and I came home to live with my parents, my son spent the night under a different roof. Jason showed up unexpectedly the weekend before Memorial Day. The season would officially kick off in a week. I was already booked for 27 parties. I was in the kitchen making hundreds of bacon-wrapped dates that I could freeze for future use when I heard the doorbell. He dropped to one knee on my mother's front porch, opened the ring box, and asked me to marry him. I screamed so loudly that a passing bicyclist almost swerved into traffic. He had every detail planned out. We'd move into his rental for the summer. I'd hire extra helpers to work the catering jobs I had already booked and would stop accepting orders. We'd return with him to the city in the fall. He'd ask friends to pull strings to get Spencer into a good school. He wanted to get married at Gurney's this summer if it wasn't too soon. Last October, he'd put down a deposit to hold a date in July. "You're insane," I told him. "I know what that place costs. You paid a fortune all on a bet."
"I don't bet. When you're an economist, it's called researching and playing the market.
When you're a normal human, it's called being a dork."
"If it helps, they gave me a discount when I told them what it was for. They love you there. Almost as much as I love you. Marry me, Angela."
I asked him why it was such a rush.
"Because I don't want to see you every 10 days. I want you with me every night."
He wrapped me in his arms and kissed my hair.
"Besides, I don't want some other summer guy laying his eyes on you at a friend's party and stealing you away from me."
"And Spencer?"
"I want him to have a father. I want to be his father. Jason, Angela, and Spencer Powell. Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it?"
At that point, Spencer had my last name, Mullen. There had never been any consideration of another option. Now that Jason was talking about marriage, I saw the benefits of becoming Angela and Spencer Powell in a big, crowded city. He would still see his grandparents. He had adjusted to kindergarten and then to first grade. He'd be able to transition to a new school. The benefits would be worth it. I still remember Jason telling me how much his parents would have loved me the night after I said yes. We got married at Gurney's on the date Jason had held, but at my request, there was no ceremony, just a dinner party for 12. No puffy gown, no veil, no announcement in the Sunday Styles section. A non-denominational minister I found on the internet showed up for cocktails to make it official. Jason's lawyer and best friend, Colin, filed the paperwork to change Spencer's name the following Monday. Legal adoption would take longer, but Spencer and I were officially pals. 2 years later, over a table at 11 Madison Park, I asked Jason if Colin was still working on making it official. His face immediately fell, as if I'd interrupted dinner to ask him to take out the garbage.
"Is this really what you want to talk about on our anniversary?"
"Of course not. It's just the date. It's a reminder. I wasn't a lawyer, but it didn't seem possible it could take this long. There was no other father in the picture. Did Colin tell you what the holdup was? I can get police reports if he needs them. I'm sure Detective Hendricks could explain." Jason rested his fork on the plate next to his half-eaten duck breast and held up a hand.
"Please,"
he whispered, looking around as if anyone had been listening.
"You're always the one saying you don't like thinking about that, that the past doesn't matter. So can we please not talk about it on our anniversary?"
"Fine," It was a reasonable request. He was right. I'd seen a counselor a few times when I first came home, but nothing that anyone would call real therapy. It was almost like I started life over again at the age of 19. I didn't need counseling. The only thing I ever needed was for people to understand that I was fine. I am fine. The couple of times Jason suggested that I talk to someone, I shut down the possibility, and not gently. For me to raise the subject in passing over the dinner table was unfair. But I couldn't ignore my suspicion that something had changed. What sounded like a pile of annoying paperwork a couple of years ago felt like an actual hurdle now, a line Jason no longer wanted to cross. Maybe it had seemed easier to imagine being a permanent father to Spencer 2 years ago when we both assumed we'd have another child, a little brother or sister for our son, together. I got pregnant the second month after our marriage. 2 months after that, I wasn't. I had never seen Jason cry before. That night, in bed, we said we'd try again. I was still so young. It only took 4 months to get another plus sign on the stick. Then, after 2 months, gone. 2 miscarriages in a year. The third time lasted almost to the first trimester mark. I was starting to look forward to sharing the news, but then we lost him, or maybe her. The doctors remained optimistic, telling me that my chances for a successful pregnancy were still over 50%. But I felt like I had already flipped that coin too many times, and it was going to keep coming up on the wrong side. I, of all people, needed predictability. I needed to know what was going to happen. And because I knew that about myself, I really only had one choice. To give up. I asked for the insertion of an IUD so I could have control over my body again. Jason did his best not to seem disappointed. He said that no matter what happened, we still had Spencer, and he was enough. But I could tell that he was trying to convince himself more than anything. And I noticed that I was the one holding him. I was the one doing the consoling. Because we both knew that in some ways the loss was more his than mine. Because Spencer would always be more mine than his. Jason didn't have a child of his own. And now Spencer still wasn't adopted. I thought maybe we'd gotten an update, I said softly. He reached across the table and held my hand. When he looked into my eyes, he was no longer frustrated. I love our son, and that's who he is now, our son. You know that, right? Of course, I smiled. It's been 2 years since you locked this down.
Best decision I ever made.
Just figured we'd have locked down Spencer legally by now, too. He gave my hand a squeeze.
Time flies when you're happy. I'll call Colin tomorrow, I promise.
He kept his promise. When Colin sat me down and explained the process, he said it would be easy. We simply needed to notify Spencer's biological father and get his permission to terminate his parental rights. Or, he explained,
if he never had any real ties to Spencer, we can argue abandonment and potentially skip the notification, if you think it's going to be a problem.
I tried to keep my voice completely neutral. He's dead.
Oh, even better.
He immediately offered an awkward apology, and I assured him it was fine.
Condolences, I guess. Anyway, all we need in that case is a copy of the death certificate.
But the father is not listed on the birth certificate. I didn't explain that he was already dead, and that Spencer was already 2 years old by the time that birth certificate was issued, listing me as his only parent.
Oh, okay.
I could tell that Colin was waiting for a more detailed explanation, but I didn't offer one.
Well, that'll be a little more complicated. The judge might ask if you know who the father is, in which case we could offer up the death certificate. They need to make sure there's not some guy out there getting his kid taken away. It shouldn't be too much of a problem.
I nodded, knowing that Spencer was never going to have a legal father. When Jason got home that night, I told him everything I had learned about the adoption procedure. That was the last time we talked about it. The paperwork isn't important. Spencer knows who his parents are. We have Jason's name. As far as anyone is concerned, Jason is Spencer's father. And that's all that matters, right? 4. The day after Rachel Sutton walked into the Midtown South Precinct, Detective Corinne Duncan received a copy of a brief report filed by the desk officer. She found herself shaking her head as she read. She skipped down to the signature line at the bottom of the page. L. Kendall. Corinne had no direct knowledge of Officer Kendall, but immediately formed a mental image of him. Him, almost certainly, not only because of raw statistical odds, but from the details of the report itself. The judgmental quotation marks around encouraged and suggested. The way he noted that she presented calmly and did not appear distraught, as if everyone knew that good victims cry. Corinne could already imagine the conversation that might have ensued had Rachel not left the precinct. What were you wearing? Why were you alone with him? Old school. L. Kendall may as well have written, "Don't believe what she might say," across the top in all caps. This was how police took a report when they meant to signal to the prosecution not to bother. If nothing else, it would give a defense attorney ammunition if the defendant were ever charged. Corinne wanted to think she had never written a report like that. She didn't start out on the job with NYPD. Her first 2 years were as a patrol officer in Hempstead, on Long Island in Nassau County. Policing was different there. With fewer than 120 officers, the department expected officers to investigate their own cases, with the exception of major crimes. So she learned things like why a child abuse victim might accuse an innocent person to protect a guilty parent, why domestic violence complainants often didn't want to prosecute, out of fear, or even love, and why sexual abuse complaints had more layers than any onion. Embarrassment didn't begin to describe the dynamics. But in the NYPD, a patrol officer like L. Kendall didn't need to know all that. He took the report and pushed the paper to a specialty unit for follow-up. She had already Googled Jason Powell. The name hadn't rung a bell in the context of a police report, but the search results immediately jogged her memory. According to his bio on New York University's website, he had a bachelor's and a master's degree from Stanford, a PhD from Harvard, and was the somebody-something endowed chair in human rights investments and professor of economics. Despite the impressiveness of that resume, it barely made the first page of Google Hits. Powell was better known as an author and speaker. The first sentence of his Wikipedia listing, Jason Powell is the New York Times best-selling author of Equalonomics, the chair of FSS Consulting, and a frequent media commentator. Corinne preferred fiction, personally, but even she had heard of Equalonomics. About 4 years ago, it had been one of those books that everyone read, or pretended to read, in Corinne's opinion, to seem well-informed. Now, according to Powell's website, he hosted a podcast bearing the same name as his best-selling book. His Twitter account, a combination of business news, liberal politics, and snark, had 226,000 followers. Cosmo had named him one of the 10 sexiest gingers. She recalled seeing the author on Morning Joe a couple of years ago. The panelists fawned over Powell, asking whether he might be interested in running for office someday. It probably didn't hurt that he was nice-looking. Trim, clean-cut, but with a little edge. A bit too pretty for Corinne's taste, but to each her own. Next, she Googled FSS Consulting. Fair Share Strategies. She clicked the About page. The company provided human rights and social justice due diligence to investors and investment groups. She wiggled her mouse, clicked on Our Team, and scrolled down. The list was short, only two names in addition to Powell's. Zachary Hawkins, executive director, and Elizabeth Marks, researcher. There was nothing more she was going to learn from her computer. She picked up her phone. The voice that answered sounded apprehensive, even slightly annoyed. Hello? Corinne asked if she was speaking with Rachel Sutton. She was. And then identified herself as a detective following up on the complaint that was filed yesterday. Oh, of course, Rachel said apologetically. I'm so glad you called. It seems like no one is listening to me. I was positive the officer at the precinct was going to file it at the bottom of a dumpster. It's all on computers, so... Right. So now what happens? Now, if you don't mind, you get to repeat everything you already told Officer Kendall to me. We'll go from there. Rachel laughed softly. Are you going to roll your eyes and interrupt me every few seconds, trying to make it sound like I'm lying? Was that your experience at the precinct? The guy was a jerk. I mean, I sort of expected that when I reported it at FSS because Jason's the boss. So I wound up at the police station, but that managed to be worse. Okay, we'll talk all about it, but in person. Most detectives arranged interviews at the precinct, which for the Special Victims Unit meant a station house on 123rd Street in an area of East Harlem that many victims were afraid to enter. Corinne, however, believed she learned a lot about people by seeing where they lived. And sitting down in a victim's living room was a way to begin earning her trust. Are you home now? Yeah, give me an hour to get cleaned up. And already, Corinne had learned something about Rachel Sutton. She was the kind of person who tidied up before talking to a detective about a sex abuse claim. That fact meant nothing on its own, but Corinne made a mental note of it, because Corinne liked to think she noticed everything. Rachel's apartment in Chelsea was one of those generic new buildings popping up across Manhattan, all floor-to-ceiling glass. Ticky, tacky fishbowls, Corinne called them. Corinne, on the other hand, had a house, an actual hand-to-God house, with a yard and a driveway, because she'd bought in Harlem before hipsters decided Harlem was cool. A 5-minute walk to work was only one reason Corinne had asked to come back to SVU after working homicides for 4 years. She told the doorman she was there to see Rachel Sutton, gesturing toward the badge hanging from the chain around her neck. Years ago, after only 2 weeks as a plainclothes detective, Corinne had opted for that placement. No one had confused her with a nanny or a housekeeper when she wore a blue uniform. Rachel answered her apartment door in cropped boyfriend jeans and a black tank top. Her long, dark brown hair was pulled into a ponytail at the nape of her neck, and she had applied her makeup in that way that made it look like she wasn't wearing makeup. As Rachel gestured for her to take a seat in the living room, Corinne noticed a smear of ink on the back of Rachel's hand, like a temporary tattoo, a couple of inches from a Tiffany-cut solitaire that Corinne guessed was a full 2 carats. "Nice place," Corinne observed, even though to her it seemed like a photograph from any modern furniture catalog. "Thanks, my mom did everything." Her shrug seemed to acknowledge her good fortune. "I haven't told her about Jason yet. She's gonna freak." "And no way will she let me keep working there. At FSS?" "Yeah. It's an amazing opportunity for me. Jason's basically the leading voice at the cross-section of finance and international human rights. And now this. I don't want to blow up my whole professional life before it started." Corinne suggested that they talk first about what happened, before they discussed what actions might follow. Rachel explained that she was getting her master's degree in economics at NYU and had an internship for credit at Jason's consulting firm. She'd entered Jason's office to deliver a memo she had drafted. "I didn't see him at his desk, but he must have heard me walk in because he called me into his spa room." "His what?" Corinne asked. "That's what the interns call it. He's got this huge private bathroom with a shower and a little daybed to the side. Sometimes he closes the door, and we think he takes naps in there. A couple of the interns joke that he might actually live at the office. Anyway, I walked in there, and his pants were undone. I started to turn away, and he said it was nothing I hadn't seen before. Then he kept talking to me like it's normal. But he was touching himself the entire time." "His genitals were exposed?" Rachel shook her head. "No, or at least I didn't see. His hands were in his pants. I can't describe it. And it was so fast, and I was sort of freaked out. So then he looked at the memo in my hand and saw my ring. He said something about whether it was a conflict diamond." Rachel must have seen the confusion on Corinne's face, because she paused for an explanation. "There are diamonds that come illegally from war-torn areas, same thing as blood diamonds." Corinne nodded to indicate she was following along. "I told him I really didn't know. I held my hand up like an idiot, telling him how I got engaged last weekend." "Congratulations," Corinne said. "Well, as if he'd care." "I was nervous, trying to find something to talk about. He took the memo from me, and I started to turn around to leave, but he kind of grabbed my other arm. Not hard, but just sort of held it. Like he was keeping me from walking off. I thought maybe he was going to skim my memo and ask some follow-up questions while I was there. But then he kind of pulled me back toward him, and his belt buckle was still undone. He told me I was too young to get married. I hadn't had enough fun yet. It was clear to me that he was about to put my hand against, you know. I jumped back immediately." Corinne asked what happened next. "Nothing. I kind of stepped backward and pulled my hand away really abruptly. I didn't know what to say. And then he turned away, fastened his belt, and started flipping through the memo like it was no big deal. He told me he'd let me know if he had any questions, and then I left." Corinne asked Rachel whether she'd spoken to anyone about the incident. "I told Zach Hawkins. He's the executive director, officially the person in charge of the interns." Corinne recalled the name from the FSS website. "I was so shocked," Rachel said. "I found myself in his office telling him what had happened." Corinne asked if Zach said what he was planning to do about her complaint. "He said he'd talk to Jason about it, that he was sure it was some kind of misunderstanding." Her dismay that there could be any confusion about Jason's conduct was clear in her tone. It was still eating away at me after work, so I went to the police precinct. Did you talk to anyone else about the incident? Maybe your fiancé? Rachel looked surprised by the mention of a fiancé. I'm still getting used to that word, she said, admiring her ring. No, I didn't tell Mike, for the same reason I didn't tell my mother. I don't want to make a big deal of this. I'm a police detective, Rachel. Are you saying you don't want to press charges? Like I said, I don't know, but I didn't feel right not saying anything. What if I let it go and he ended up doing something worse to another woman? I guess I just wanted to file a report so it would be there. Do you know if this is the first time he's done this? Corinne told her that the NYPD had no prior complaints. Rachel's lips pursed. There's no way for me to prove what happened, is there? It's my word against his, the classic he said, she said. Yes, Corinne thought. And even if she had the entire incident on video, it wasn't obviously a crime. According to Rachel, Jason never touched her on an intimate body part and didn't clearly expose his own to her. After a few follow-up questions, she confirmed that Rachel's allegations, if she could prove them, might be considered an attempt to commit an offensive physical touching, a Class B misdemeanor. Theoretically, a maximum sentence of 6 months, but much more likely to lead to probation and some form of counseling. And that's assuming we can prove that his intention was to place your hand on his genitals, Corinne added. Should I have lied and said he did it? Rachel asked. No, because that's not what happened, right? Rachel shook her head and wiped away a tear. Sorry, I'm frustrated. Have you thought about reporting it to the university? Isn't your internship through the school? Technically, but it's more like a job, and Jason's basically a rock star at NYU. Plus, he's got tenure, so I assume they won't do anything. To be honest, my guess is that a lot of the female students wouldn't have pulled away. I'm not sure I want to be that woman on campus. She looked down as if pondering her fingernails. So, does this mean you're not going to do anything? My next step would usually be to talk to any witnesses, but you say there weren't any. I'd speak to Zach to confirm that you reported the incident right afterward. Ask him about your demeanor. And I'd usually speak to the suspect before concluding my investigation. That's if you want me to proceed. I can't promise he'll be charged. That's up to a prosecutor. But at least the reports will be there. Rachel nodded. Is that what you want? When Rachel answered, she no longer sounded like a confused, conflicted student worried about unwanted attention and a detour from her carefully planned professional track. Her voice was calm and decisive. Yes, I'm positive. I just want him to admit what he did to me. As Corinne walked to her car, she thought about all of the reasons no ADA would ever touch this case for prosecution. The delay in reporting, Rachel's defensiveness with Officer Kendall, the fleeting nature of the interaction, the absence of any type of force, not to mention the stamp of ink on the back of Rachel's hand left over from a club, possibly from the previous night, only hours after the incident. The complaint wasn't quite right, but they never were. That was a truth that every sex offense investigator would admit if it weren't wholly unacceptable. You're not supposed to say that victims never tell the complete truth because it sounds as if you're calling them liars. They're not liars. They're protecting themselves. They're preparing not to be believed. They're anticipating all the ways that others will attack them and are building a protective shield. All things being equal, Corinne believed that something had happened to Rachel yesterday, or at least Rachel believed it had happened. The main reason Corinne thought Rachel was telling the truth? Because a liar would have made up something far, far worse. She called her lieutenant from the car. He didn't understand why she was calling him about a stupid misdemeanor until she explained who Jason Powell was. He responded with an annoyed obscenity. As expected, he played hot potato and told her to call an assistant district attorney. She called the New York DA's office Special Victims Bureau and asked for the supervising ADA, Brian King. He answered after 3.5 rings.
Hold on a sec. Sorry, I'm inhaling lunch before a sentencing hearing. I wasn't going to pick up until I recognized your number.
I'm honored.
She told King everything she knew so far about Rachel's complaint.
Schadenfreude, he said. Every time my ex-girlfriend saw him on TV, she used to turn up the volume. Have you questioned him yet?
No, we thought we'd get you roped in early. Make sure we do this right. One way to play it is to pop in and have a little chat. Get his side of the story. Maybe he admits something.
She let her voice trail off.
Or maybe he kicks you out, calls a lawyer, and brings in a hazmat team to scrub down his sex den.
Lots of men have private bathrooms in their offices.
I don't see this going anywhere,
You know that, right?
Won't be the first time. I just work the case. My guess is Rachel won't want to press charges if it's his word against hers, but I won't know until I at least ask the question.
Fair enough. I'm thrilled to be involved early on, he said sarcastically.
Corinne was a few blocks away from the FSS offices when her cell phone rang. She had only dialed Rachel Sutton's phone number once, but she recognized it on the screen. Detective Duncan, she answered. Rachel identified herself, apologized for bothering her, and said she remembered something. His underwear. They were white boxer shorts with red candy canes. It was so ludicrous I almost laughed. Does that help at all? In a case of he said, she had just racked up one small point on her side of the board. 5. Detective Corinne Duncan. Interview May 15th, 1:55 p.m. Location, 1057 Avenue of the Americas, FSS Strategies. I went to location to contact Jason Powell regarding a complaint filed by Rachel Sutton. I was told that Powell was not in the office. I then asked to speak with Zachary Hawkins, Executive Director of FSS Strategies. I identified myself as an NYPD detective to Hawkins and informed him that an intern had reported an incident allegedly occurring the previous day. Hawkins nodded, as if he knew what I was referring to. He said that Jason Powell had left earlier in the day for a business trip to Philadelphia, even though I had not indicated to him yet that the intern's complaint concerned Mr. Powell. I asked him directly, "Do you know why I'm here?" He said without hesitation, "This is about Rachel, right?" Hawkins reported that he studied under Powell at NYU and began working at FSS after a few years at a hedge fund. He explained that this is the first time FSS has supervised student interns under pressure from the university because Powell is still a professor while pursuing outside business endeavors. Rachel Sutton is one of four interns spending approximately 6 to 10 hours per week at FSS, primarily researching potential investments. Hawkins indicated that Rachel Sutton went to his office the previous day, asked to speak with him, and closed his office door. She reported that Jason Powell had sexually harassed her. She stated that Powell had been inappropriate with her. According to Hawkins, when he pressed Sutton further for details, she responded, "He's the one who should explain himself." I asked Hawkins what he did in response to her complaint. He admitted that he has no training in responding to workplace complaints and that FSS is too small to have a human resources department. He said that he spoke with Jason Powell, who appeared completely shocked and even outraged by the question. Powell indicated that he could not think of any explanation for the complaint except for a brief conversation regarding Rachel Sutton's recent engagement. I asked Hawkins if he had any other information to provide regarding the incident, and he said he did not. He said he was stunned and disappointed that the police were involved, indicating his belief that there was a misunderstanding between the two parties. After leaving FSS, I telephoned Jason Powell at a cell phone number provided by Hawkins. I identified myself as an NYPD detective, I did not specify SVU, and told him that I wanted to speak to him about a complaint I had received. He immediately stated that he would not answer questions unless he was in the presence of counsel. Action. Reports forwarded to ADA King, New York DA's Office Special Victims Bureau. 6. 3 days later. This is how I found out. I am used to waking up alone, depending on which moment you count as waking up. The first time is usually around 3 in the morning. Jason doesn't know about these restless minutes. No one does. I tell myself they don't matter, that they're not real. They have nothing to do with my life as an adult in this house with Jason and Spencer. These lost blocks of time belong to the person I used to be. It's as if sleep carries me into a time machine and I emerge briefly as my younger self. Terrified, lonely, but more than anything, flat. That is how I used to feel all the time. Now it's only how I wake up, the first time, in the middle of the night after an awful dream. I forced myself to close my eyes and follow the alphabet game that Jason taught Spencer when we first spent the night under one roof together. Spencer was nearly 7 years old at the time. He was used to falling asleep on Long Island to the sounds of ocean wind and the hum of cicadas. Jason's guest room was 15 floors above 74th Street, but Spencer could not adapt to the staccato eruptions of sirens and honking horns. He stepped into the living room in his Batman pajamas, rubbing his sleepy eyes. I looked apologetically to Jason and started to get up to take Spencer back to bed, but Jason pulled him onto the sofa between us.
Start by thinking of something you like, a cartoon, a TV show, a subject in school.
I wasn't surprised when Spencer chose Harry Potter. He was an advanced reader for his age, but I suspected that the movies and my mother had helped him work his way through the books.
Excellent, Jason said. Now, close your eyes. Start with the letter A. Do you know your letters?
Spencer smiled and nodded, eyes still closed. He had begun reading when he was only 4. Jason explained the game. Start with A and think of something related to Harry Potter.
Aunt Petunia.
Then to B,
broomstick.
I could tell from my son's face that he was no longer scared of the street outside. His mind was busy, inside a Harry Potter story. It was the first time I felt sure that Jason was going to love my son, not just me. Jason promised him that if he went back to bed and played the game, he'd be asleep again by the time he made it to Z. This is how I spend those middle-of-the-night minutes, working through the alphabet, our family's non-pharmaceutical Ambien, usually in the world of a familiar television show like Scandal or Friends, something to make time pass. Anywhere except inside the dream that woke me in the first place, back in that house in Pittsburgh. The second time I wake up, barely, is when Jason's alarm goes off at precisely 5:30 a.m., by the time I met him, his schedule called for getting up early so he could work on the book he hoped to publish someday. Once that plan had worked, the timeline was set in stone. As for me, the day doesn't actually begin until my 7 o'clock alarm, at which point my daily routine kicks in. I start with my iPad, check email, browse Facebook, skim the headlines. But I give myself 15 minutes max, followed by a 2-minute plank and a couple of stretches to get the blood moving. I swing by Spencer's room to make sure he gets up, and then it's down to the kitchen to make breakfast. Boring? Yes. But I'm a firm believer in routine. Predictability is comforting. It's safe. I first learned Rachel, the intern's last name, from my iPad. From Facebook, to be precise. Jason hadn't brought up the incident since initially mentioning it at dinner. He'd spent 2 days in Philadelphia. By the time he came home, I had actually forgotten about it. I assumed that if an intern's complaint had moved beyond Zach, Jason would have mentioned it. On the right side of the screen, beneath the name of an Oscar winner who was in the middle of a contested divorce and that of an athlete I barely recognized, were the words Jason Powell. My husband was trending. For a split second, I felt excitement, but then I clicked on the link. After a quick skim of the article, I reached for the remote control on the nightstand and turned to New Day, where Jason was scheduled for a segment this morning. They were on a commercial break. I clicked over to MSNBC, where Jason was also a frequent contributor. The Morning Joe panel was interviewing some congressman I'd never heard of. No mention of Jason on the crawl beneath the program. I flipped up 3 stations to the channel that focused on finance issues. Nothing. One more click up to the leading conservative station. A photograph of Jason appeared in the upper right-hand corner, not far from the face of the attractive blonde who was speaking his name. And then I saw the letters in a banner across the bottom of the screen. Progressive celebrity economist accused of intern sex abuse. The article was from the Post, and 3,000 Facebook users had already shared it. The paper had pulled a photo from Jason's listing on the university's website. Jason looked so young. His long face was fuller then, and he wasn't yet sporting the short stubble look he'd adopted a few years ago. His green eyes seemed to stare straight through the camera. And he was smiling as if he had thought of a joke. The article itself was only 2 paragraphs long. It said that an unnamed college intern had accused economist turned pundit and political lightning rod Jason Powell of involuntary sexual contact. An inside source tells the Post that the dirty professor keeps a secret room with a shower and a bed adjacent to the ritzy off-campus office where he has been earning a mint telling investors how to spend their money according to his liberal politics. The same source reports that the NYPD is close to making an arrest and that we will soon be learning more about the various uses to which the renowned economist has been putting the bed in question. I had to stop myself from throwing the iPad on the floor. When we first moved downtown, Jason missed being able to run in Central Park every day. Splurging for that shower when he opened FSS had been a way to get back to his old running routes.